frowning as he stepped up to her. She wasn't nearly as old as he'd thought, he saw now, probably no more than her late 40s or early 50s. She had a proper ID badge clipped to her jumpsuit's breast pocket, but he couldn't recall seeing her here before. Her accent was odd, too, a bit like Havenite, but with something else mixed in. Who are you?
I'm Elsie, sir,
she said, reaching for her ID badge. Fumbling for it, rather. Her hands were trembling too violently for her to work the clip. It made a nice counterpoint to the quivering of her lower lip, Paco thought scornfully. The woman was terrified, all right. As well she should be. If she'd heard any of Paco's Unilink conversation, any of it, she was in for the high jump. What are you doing here? He demanded.
I came to pray.
The woman gave up her attempt to unclip her badge and instead folded her hands together like they'd been when Paco first saw her.
The others, they laugh and make fun of me when I pray. I come here to kneel in the sunlight and speak to the Lord.
Paco glanced around. Sure enough, one of the warehouse's dingy viewports was directly across from her, the sunlight rising and waning in time with the station's rotation. Yeah, he said, looking back at her. But I ordered everyone out of this area. Weren't you listening?
It was my break time,
Elsie protested. Her hands had unclasped in her agitation and were now moving together in a sort of nervous kneading motion.
I was told I must come in here and pray. The others, they would laugh at me if they knew.
Paco sighed. She was right about that anyway. None of the other warehouse workers cared much for religion of any sort, and they could be pretty nasty to anyone who did. But even though Paco agreed with them, he had a sister who'd gone all in a few years ago. Under normal circumstances, he probably would have bent the rules and let Elsie go with a warning to never ignore his orders again. Unfortunately, the situation here wasn't normal. I understand, he said. But you've disobeyed a direct order, Elsie. We have to go put it on the official record.
I understand,
Elsie said, her shoulders slumping as she bowed her head.
Must we do it now?
Right now, Paco said, scowling. Damn her anyway. Now he was going to have to figure out how and where to hide a body until the red hands left with their crates. He couldn't very well shove her out a lock. Things that were together in orbit tended to stay that way. Better to let the pirates deal with her, somewhere between picking up their cargo, ferrying it to their hidden ship, and heading out to the hyperlimit. They would have a whole universe worth of empty space to drop a body in. On the other hand, asking for a favor like that could be a very bad idea. If he let it slip that someone had overheard their conversation, there was a good chance he would join her in the long float into infinity. He would just have to lock her in the office for now, give the red hands their stuff, and then figure out what the hell to do with her. At least she would have her religion to comfort her when she saw death coming. Maybe there was even a god out there somewhere who would actually take her in or something. Let's go, he said, gesturing with the gun. The office is this way.
Yes, of course, she said,
her shoulders still slumped with dejection. She stumbled toward him, her feet dragging on the floor. As she passed, her foot caught on something, and she started to topple forward. Reflexively, Paco reached out and grabbed her arm with his free hand to steady her. The last thing he saw before the lights went out was her other forearm as it slammed into the side of his head. She had the crates lined up in the staging area when the shuttle arrived. The men who came out of it were large, rough-looking, and well-armed. And suspicious. Highly suspicious. Who are you? The one in the lead demanded as he strode up to her.
Elsie Dorman, she said, tapping her ID badge. Paco's a bit indisposed, so he sent me to meet you.
Did he now? The man said, flicking a glance over her shoulder. And you are?
I already told you, Elsie. I'm Paco's partner.
He never mentioned a partner.
She shrugged.
I'm new.
How new?
Oh,
she consulted her chrono.
As of 15 minutes ago?
That was when Paco found out, anyway.
I've known for a year.
Yeah?
The man's hand dropped to the butt of his sidearm.
Oh, relax, she said scornfully. The crates are right here, with whatever you've got in them. You're here, and your ship's location could be pulled from the nav log in 2 minutes. If I was a cop or part of a rival gang, we wouldn't still be talking.
Sure, the man said suspiciously. Bosk, check the seals on the crates, will you? Then open one.
It took them 3 minutes to check all the seals, then pop one open and paw through the upper layer of contents. During that entire time, the man just stared silently at the woman. Rather like some first dates she'd had, she thought dryly.
Looks good, Bosk reported. Nothing missing or tampered with. You want me to seal it back up?
Yeah, and then get everything aboard. He cocked his head. I assume you unlocked the gantry so we could use it?
She waved toward the big crane hanging from the ceiling above the crates.
Help yourself.
One of the other pirates was already in the control booth, and she watched in silence as he snagged the first crate and lowered it into the container.
So I guess we're dealing with you now?
The boss asked as the second crate began its own journey downward.
If you want to keep using this warehouse, sure, she said. If not, that's okay too. I figured this to be just a one-off until I got a whiff of who Paco was dealing with. If you want to keep going, just let me know. You can keep using Paco's Unilink number.
She held out her hand, palm upward.
But whatever you decide, I'll take my payment for this job now.
For another long moment, he just gazed at her. Then, snorting a little chuckle, he pulled out a chip and tossed it toward her.
You've got brass, Elsie. I'll give you that. We'll be in touch. Maybe.
I look forward to it, she said, deftly catching the chip and slipping it into her pocket. Maybe.
He gave her a tight smile and turned back to the shuttle. 10 minutes later, with all six crates safely inside the container, they sealed the hatch and headed back to their shuttle. She watched through the side viewport as they maneuvered to the container, wrapped the locking arms around it, then headed out. She watched until the glow of their drive had disappeared from the small viewport beside the hatch. Then she retraced her steps back into the main part of the warehouse, heaving a sigh of relief. It had been touch and go there, first with the embarrassing foot scuff that had alerted Paco while she was sealing the last crate's hidden compartment, and then with the hastily improvised roll she'd had to throw together to play for the pirates. But it had worked, so far. And now, in the relative anonymity of the warehouse, she finally pulled out her Unilink and keyed it on.
Owl one to owl, she said tersely. Owlets have left the nest. Mouse hunt is on. Repeat, mouse hunt is on.
Mouse hunt, copy,
the woman on the other end said just as tersely.
I'll be there in 15,
the woman said, peeling off her jumpsuit with one hand to reveal the innocuous civilian clothing beneath it.
Out.
2 minutes later, she was in the lift heading for her shuttle. The Solway authorities would be highly displeased if they knew she was here, and even angrier if they knew she and her colleagues were about to dig into the kickback structure that had served them so well with so many pirates, marauders, and under-the-radar mercs over the years. But she wasn't worried. The Republic of Haven Navy didn't answer to anyone on Solway. Scaife, the 303rd Special Commando Assault Force, Expeditionary, answered to only one person. And the Red Hands were going down today. Major Elsie Dorman, hand-picked for this job by Brigadier Jean Massengill herself, was absolutely damn sure of that. It took the RHNS Terrier almost 2 hours after making it past Solway's hyperlimit and into the Alpha Band to find Bloodlust.
Finally,
Ambassador-at-Large Louis Joffrey said from behind Massengill's station when CIC finally confirmed that the ship in the distance was indeed their target pirate vessel.
I was afraid they'd gotten away. There was never any chance of that, Massengill assured him, keeping her own relief out of her voice.
Elsie Dorman was adept at everything having to do with cargoes, pirates, and bureaucracies, and Lieutenant Bastange's 40-man platoon was one of the best teams in the 303rd. But in any military operation, there was the chance that something would go horribly wrong. In this case, that clearly hadn't happened. Bloodlust was sitting quietly in the middle of nowhere, her wedge down, her nodes cold. With a couple of nodes out of commission, and her hyperdrive having presumably succumbed to Bastange's doorbuster, the comm pinged.
Owl 2 to Owl, Bastange's voice came from the speaker. Mouse is trapped. Repeat, mouse is trapped.
And with Bloodlust's comm system successfully tapped into, the 303rd was officially in the catbird's seat. Massengill smiled,
her first genuine smile since the team arrived in Solway space 6 days ago.
Owl copy, she said. Stand by.
So that's it?
Joffrey asked.
It's over?
It's about to be,
Massengill assured him.
Calm?
The comm officer nodded.
Ready, ma'am.
Massengill adjusted her uniform collar with one hand and tapped the mic switch with the other.
Pirate ship Bloodlust. This is Brigadier Jean Massengill aboard the Republic of Haven fast transport ship Terrier. I'm the commander of the men who have infiltrated your ship and disabled your impellers and hyperdrive.
She considered.
Actually, considering the firepower my commandos brought aboard, your hyperdrive probably isn't so much disabled as it is a collection of charred metal shavings on the deck.
She paused, waiting for the usual outrage and denials, but the Bloodlust's captain had apparently decided to skip that page.
So here's the deal, she continued. You'll immediately shut down your reactor, just to make sure nobody tries anything rash. Then you'll gather your crew in your impeller rooms and prepare to receive boarders. More boarders, I should say.
This is Captain Blaine of the Cornucopia,
a dark voice came. Apparently he'd finally found the standard script.
I don't know who you think you are, Terrier, but the Solway enforcers are not going to be happy at this flagrant abuse of their jurisdictional authority. In point of fact, it is you who are committing piracy.
Massengill let him finish his rant. Sometimes they believed their protests meant something. Usually they just wanted to get it on someone's record. Eventually he ran dry.
I appreciate your legal and ethical concerns, she said. Let me point out the concerns you should be thinking about. With no impellers, you're not going anywhere. With no hyperdrive, you're stuck in the alpha band while not going anywhere. Basically, you're not going anywhere. Not before you run out of air or starve.
She paused, waiting for more protests. But they didn't come. Not really surprising. By now, Blaine would be fully aware of the damage his ship had sustained, and knew that if Terrier took off, he and everyone aboard was dead.
So here's the deal, Massengill said. You can die, or you can surrender and let us take you in tow to Haven.
What about your men?
Blaine bit out, pulling out his final card.
You going to leave them to die too?
Oh, I'm sure they've already picked out which shuttle they'll be leaving in, Massengill said. None of that will change your own endgame. You surrender or you die, and either way, the Red Hand's piracy stops forever.
And if we accede to your outrageous demands?
Your piracy still stops, Massengill said. But you'll still be alive.
At least until the show trial has concluded?
There may not be a trial, Massengill said. There are always pre-trial interrogations, and often pre-trial deals to be made. In particular, we're very interested in the details about your work with three other groups who've been working the Beowulf Haven trade route.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sure it'll come to you, Massengill said. I hope so, anyway. Because if you can't tell us anything, there'll be nothing to do but move on to that show trial you mentioned.
She touched a switch on her board.
I'm launching my shuttles now. I suggest you prepare to receive them. Peaceably, of course.
Of course, the captain said bitterly. What other choice do we have?
Dying before dinner time, Massengill said pointedly. Good day, Captain. I'll look forward to meeting you in person soon.
Massengill out. She keyed the switch and turned to face Joffrey.
Now it's over, she told him.
Good, Joffrey said, puffing out a sigh of relief.
Though he's right on one point. We could still be in trouble if Solway enforcement catches us.
They won't, Massengill assured him, suppressing the impulse to roll her eyes. Back on Haven, she'd argued long and hard against Joffrey's presence aboard her ship. Given that there was no way the local authorities could tumble to her team's presence in the system, let alone catch them in the act of nailing the Red Hand's main ship, there was no reason to saddle her with a diplomat. But the upper brass, more likely the politicians above them, hadn't seen it that way. They'd insisted that Joffrey come along as an official Havenite representative, just in case Massengill troubled any waters that needed to be soothed. A complete waste of time, as it turned out. Most of that time Joffrey's. But the man had been decent enough company on the voyage, and he mostly reserved his questions for when Massengill wasn't in the middle of something important. Still, having a politician tag along on a purely military mission wasn't a precedent she particularly liked. Hopefully, once the analysts in NAV-INT finished sorting through the leads and the 303rd had stomped all the pirates and pirate bases they were able to locate, the political aspect would be filed away and forgotten.
I hope not, Joffrey said. As long as we have a moment, may I ask you a question?
Again, Massengill managed not to roll her eyes.
Of course.
I believe I heard somewhere that you grew up on Manticore, Joffrey said.
I was wondering.
Actually, my husband and I grew up on Earth, Massengill said. We were recruited by Manticore 25 years ago, then emigrated to Haven 10 years ago. That should all be in my file.
Ah, Joffrey said.
My apologies. That will teach me to read past the summary page. I was just wondering what you thought about the Star Kingdom's recent 1-2 punch.
Massengill turned away from him, not wanting to trust herself to hold a neutral expression. The sudden, violent attack on Manticore, followed by the equally sudden and violent deaths of King Edward and Crown Princess Sophie. The news had arrived at Solway a few weeks before the Terrier's arrival, and there was still a sort of distant numbness in Massengill's brain whenever she thought about it. She had also spent a fair amount of that time planning how she would present a recommendation to her superiors that the Republic reach out to the Star Kingdom. She wasn't sure what form that assistance should take. Military aid, investigative aid, or heightened patrols in that area. But it was going to be tricky. Nouveau Paris didn't like sticking its nose into other nations' affairs, nor did it like overstretching its resources, and any flavor of aid to Manticore could be perceived as both. The message to Solway had included few details, but Massengill could read between the lines, and it was painfully clear that if Tamerlane had enough of a reserve force for a second attack, there would be virtually nothing Manticore could do to stop it.
I think the Manticorans are a lot tougher than anyone realizes, she told Joffrey. I'm also confident that the government will be able to come together and work through whatever constitutional issues the death of the king and the heir apparent have created.
Yes, Joffrey murmured. There's an old saying about that. Something about a ship and a raft, but I don't remember the details.
A monarchy is a merchantman which sails well, but will sometimes strike on a rock and go to the bottom, Massengill quoted. A republic is a raft which will never sink, but then your feet are always in the water. I don't remember the source.
I'm impressed, Joffrey said.
I really am. I had no idea you were a scholar.
I'm not, Massengill said.
Alvis ran into that quote when we were first considering emigrating to Manticore. I know they're not the only monarchy out here, but it was still a bit of a concern for us. But they seem to have it under control.
Well, let's hope they haven't struck a rock on this one, Joffrey said.
They've been decent allies and friends over the years. I don't necessarily agree with their system of government, but I'd hate to see it collapse.
Agreed.
Massengill raised her eyebrows.
Perhaps you'd be willing to put that sentiment into action.
What sort of action?
He countered, his expression shifting into the genial mask of a man who knows he's about to be asked for a favor.
Nothing drastic, Massengill assured him. I know you have a number of high-level contacts in the government. I thought you might be willing to suggest to them that Haven and Manticore work together on whatever follow-up investigation or action is required.
Meaning you want Nouveau Paris to commit ships to Manticore's defense?
It wouldn't take much of a force, Massengill said. And it wouldn't be for very long. Manticore has a strong industrial base, and I'm guessing they'll be able to repair the damaged ships within a few months. I imagine they're also pulling their mothballed vessels back to active duty as quickly as possible.
Joffrey pondered a moment. That assumes the Manticorans would be willing to allow a group of foreign warships in orbit over their capital.
They might not, and if they weren't, our ships would have made a long trip for nothing.
Massengill felt her lip twist, but he was right. She'd known Admiral Locatelli back in the day, and First Lord Casanestro had always seemed like a reasonable sort, but the final decision on these things rested with the monarch, and the brand new Queen Elizabeth was a complete unknown.
You're right, she conceded. I suppose we have to wait for them to ask.
That's generally best,
Joffrey said. Unfortunately, the time delay means that even if they asked tomorrow, we couldn't get them any help for nearly a year, which is, of course, precisely the time frame when they would most likely need us.
True, Massengill said reluctantly. I'm just hoping Nouveau Paris sent something as soon as they learned of the attack. If Manticore sent word to Solway, they surely sent word to Haven. My fear is that they're still dithering about it.
I realize politics can be frustrating, Joffrey said. But knee-jerk reactions without proper consideration can be just as catastrophic.
I note that when we pinpointed Solway as one of the Red Hand's transfer points, you didn't just load up and charge into battle. You paused to think and plan and reconnoiter before you made your move.
He gestured toward the display.
And we see how all that prep work paid off.
I suppose, Massengill said. Not quite the same as loading a few ships we don't need for our own defense and sending them to aid a friend.
Ah, but what if we did need them for our defense? Joffrey countered. What if the people who hit Manticore are a new brotherhood sort of group?
In that case, sending a pair of our battlecruisers away might just make the difference between victory and annihilation.
Massengill scowled. Far-fetched to an extreme. But far-fetched didn't necessarily mean wrong. And he was right. The Republic of Haven Navy's first responsibility was to defend the Republic of Haven. If push came to shove, Manticore was on its own.
But I'll give you this much, Joffrey continued. If and when Manticore requests aid of whatever sort, I'll make sure that request is given Nouveau Paris' full attention. If we can assist without endangering our own people, I'll push hard to make it so.
Fair enough?
Fair enough, Massengill said.
The words were relatively meaningless, of course, given the uncertainties of who and what Manticore was up against. But at this point, words were all she was going to get. Maybe later the situation would change. If so, she would be ready to remind Joffrey about this conversation.
Brigadier? The comm officer spoke up. Sergeant Cochrane reports his shuttle is docked. Sergeant Noli is about 2 minutes behind them, both leaders prepping for simultaneous boarding.
Massengill took a deep breath. Time to get her mind back into this particular game.
Inform Lieutenant Bastange, she ordered. He may want to move out while the Red Hands have their attention split, especially since letting them see what's left of their hyperdrive might help them make up their minds.
Yes, ma'am.
And warn the boarding parties to be careful, she added unnecessarily. The pirates could still decide to be stupid today.
Chapter 14. Prime Minister Burgundy and Chancellor of the Exchequer Breakwater were waiting when Elizabeth arrived in the palace conference room. The two men, standing on opposite sides of the long table, turned in unison as the door opened, bowing at the sovereign's approach.
Your Majesty,
Burgundy greeted her for both of them.
Your Grace, my Lord,
Elizabeth greeted them in return, wondering uneasily what was going on. After the last chaotic 2 T-months, at least she no longer felt as if she'd fallen into a drug-induced dream, or nightmare, whenever someone called her Majesty. The job that went with the title, though, was a different matter entirely, and she especially hated walking into a situation cold. All Burgundy had said in this case was that Breakwater wanted to talk about some matters that were about to be brought before the Lords, and to give her advance notice. That alone wasn't particularly worrisome. Breakwater was one of several cabinet ministers who liked to get the Queen's input or approval on a given piece of legislation before bringing it into the public eye. Elizabeth had wondered about that until Burgundy suggested that it was all part of the process of getting a feel for Manticore's new queen. The same ministers had done the same to Edward when he ascended the throne, he told her, and assured her the private audience requests would eventually fade away. What concerned her was the fact that Burgundy had insisted on accompanying the Chancellor on this one. That automatically raised it above the usual testing-the-water meetings that she'd become used to. Elizabeth had always known that politics was a complex and arcane profession. She just never realized how deeply nuanced it was. Getting thrown headfirst into the deep end of the pool hadn't helped either. Edward had been careful to keep Richard up to speed on matters of state, and in the brief time that Sophie had been crown princess, he'd started the same process with her. No one had ever thought Elizabeth might need those briefings, including Elizabeth herself. That, among many other things, would have to change. But she had a few months under her belt now, and was finally starting to get the hang of this. Hopefully, whatever Breakwater was about to pitch would be something she already knew how to handle.
"We appreciate your seeing us on such short notice,"
Burgundy continued, as Elizabeth seated herself at the head of the table. Once she was settled, he also sat down, taking the seat one chair down the table to her right, where he would be close enough for easy conversation, but not so close that he was encroaching on her personal space. Breakwater, probably following the same logic, took the seat opposite him.
"As I mentioned earlier, Earl Breakwater has two matters he wished to bring to your attention."
"Understood." Elizabeth focused on Breakwater. "Go ahead, my lord."
"Thank you, your majesty," Breakwater said gravely. "Let me be brief. Regarding the first matter, I wanted you to know that some of the lords will be proposing a resolution tomorrow calling for the official censure of Commodore Rudolf Heisman for his failure to properly protect Crown Prince Richard during the Battle of Manticore."
Elizabeth flashed a glance at Burgundy. The Prime Minister's jaw was set, his face wooden.
"That's very interesting, my lord," she said to Breakwater. "Particularly since the Navy has already cleared him of any wrongdoing in that matter."
"The Navy naturally has their own agenda," Breakwater said. "And yes, I've heard their argument that there was no time for Prince Richard's ship to decelerate and escape before the attackers arrived."
He lifted a finger.
"But there was time to order the same split-tail maneuver that Heisman eventually ordered for all of his remaining ships. If Hercules had done that as soon as Heisman knew the size of Tamerlane's force, it would have been well out of missile range by the time the force arrived.
And it would have cost Heisman the use of one of his ships for that battle,"
Burgundy pointed out.
"Which may or may not have made a difference," Breakwater said. "Ultimately, it was Casey's actions alone that made the difference in that particular action."
"There was no way for Heisman to know that would be the case," Elizabeth pointed out. "His job, and Richard's, was to put themselves in harm's way for the sake of the Star Kingdom."
"Perhaps," Breakwater said. "At any rate, your majesty, the point is that I wanted you to know about the resolution in advance, so that the reminder of your nephew's demise wouldn't come as a surprise."
"I appreciate your concern, my lord," Elizabeth said,
letting just a hint of sarcasm color her otherwise very proper official tone. Breakwater could talk all he wanted about how some of the lords would be bringing up this matter, as if his own heart was innocent and his hands pure as the drifting snow. But she knew better. And from the expression on Burgundy's face, it was clear that he did, too. Breakwater was a power broker, and an ambitious one, and his fingerprints were all over this. As to how she would handle it, well, that was going to take some extra study.
"You said there were two matters?"
"Yes, your majesty," Breakwater said.
Out of the corner of her eye, Elizabeth saw Burgundy's expression go even tighter.
"This one's a little more delicate, shall we say?" "Get on with it,"
Burgundy growled, and Breakwater inclined his head.
"Very well. As you may know, your majesty, the Constitution requires the sovereign to be married to a commoner. At this point, your marital status does not conform."
"Excuse me, my lord,"
Elizabeth cut him off, her stomach suddenly tightening.
"If you're suggesting what I think you're suggesting, you'd best tread very lightly."
Breakwater spread his hands.
"I make no suggestions of my own, your majesty," he protested. "I merely point out what others are already whispering, that their sovereign is out of compliance with the Constitution. I'm sure you don't want to add any further uncertainties to an already uncertain time."
He continued on, but Elizabeth could no longer hear him. All she could hear was Carmichael's voice, her eyes filling with his face, her skin tingling with his touch, his smile, his frown, his voice, his laughter.
"We are done here," she said abruptly.
She had the vague sense that Breakwater was in the middle of a sentence. She didn't care.
"You will leave now,"
she said, hearing the quavering in her voice and not caring about that either.
both of you.
She was vaguely aware of Burgundy saying the usual farewells, and then of the two of them standing up and passing on either side behind her toward the door. She saw none of it. Her head throbbed with a kaleidoscope of her life with Carmichael. The love, the comfort, the tears, the horror of his death. Slowly, the memories ebbed, gradually and reluctantly, like a receding tide, back into the recesses of her mind. She thought she'd done such a good job of burying those images away in the 4.5 T-years since he was snatched so suddenly away from her. And yet, all it had taken to bring them flooding back was a single gut-wrenching comment. She swore, softly, feelingly. When she descended the throne, as custom dictated, the entire cabinet had submitted their resignations. At Burgundy's suggestion, she'd reinstated all of them, with the goal of maintaining as much continuity as possible in the political arena until the shock of Edward's death had time to settle. Breakwater had been among the reinstated group. Now she was wishing she'd kicked him the hell out. Theoretically, it still wasn't too late to do that. She could call Burgundy back right now and ask him to form a new government without Breakwater. In practice, unfortunately, it wouldn't be that easy. Breakwater had a large following among the lords, and throwing him out without cause would not sit well with them. They weren't a majority, as near as she'd been able to calculate, but they might have enough swing to force a no-confidence vote and bring down any government Burgundy tried to form without their leader. With the Star Kingdom's citizens still twitchy from the events of the past few months, that would probably cause more harm than good. Besides which, Breakwater was a good chancellor. Everyone, supporter and opponent alike, agreed on that. He managed the Star Kingdom's money in a quiet, efficient, and exemplary way. And really, up to now, he'd mostly behaved himself. There'd been a few critical speeches, most of them centered around the kinks still being worked out in his new Empire's training center. But even the speeches had been reasonably mild in tone, more informative than incendiary. For the past couple of months, Elizabeth had almost forgotten that she needed to be on her toes around him. All that had now changed, because just like the Heisman resolution, this suggestion of non-compliance clearly wasn't coming from others in the Lords. This was being created, nurtured, and driven by Breakwater himself. With a single backstabbing gut punch, Breakwater had ended whatever truce had existed. Mentally, she shook her head. Backstabbing gut punch. She really needed to work on her metaphors, even the ones that never saw the light of day. Slowly, she got to her feet and turned around. Adler and Panescu, her two bodyguards, stood silently on either side of the doorway, waiting patiently for their sovereign to either go elsewhere or give them new orders. Despite her own proximity to the throne, she'd never had to deal with the all-pervasive and highly intrusive security which surrounded the Queen of Manticore every minute of her life. That was yet another thing she hated about this job. They'd heard every word, of course. Distantly, she wondered what they thought about her reaction.
Well, that was interesting, she said.
She wasn't sure whether the Queen should exchange idle conversation with her guards, but she'd started out that way from the beginning and saw no reason to change.
Back to the office.
The guards exchanged glances.
Your office, Your Majesty?
Panescu asked.
Yes,
Elizabeth said, frowning at him.
Why? Is there a problem?
Another set of glances.
Prime Minister Burgundy indicated that he'd wait in the library,
Adler said, her forehead creased slightly.
He said you'd want to see him.
Elizabeth pursed her lips, technically inviting himself to a conversation with his queen, as opposed to asking for an audience, was seriously overstepping the privilege of both rank and position. But now that Adler mentioned it, she rather wanted to see Burgundy too, at least for long enough to ask if he'd known in advance about Breakwater's bombshell.
Well then, she said, let's not keep him waiting.
There were several comfortable chairs and sofas in the palace library. She found Burgundy seated in the one that faced the wall-mounted royal seal. Seated across from him, directly under the seal, was former King Michael. Elizabeth hadn't seen much of her father for the past 2 weeks, though he and Elizabeth's mother, Mary, had visited almost daily during the first month after the accident. Occasionally, Edward's widow, Cynthia, had joined them as well,
as the broken remnants of the family talked and mourned together. But Cynthia had now gone back to her own family, and Michael and Mary had sequestered themselves in the tower. In seclusion, the official notices called it. Part of that, Michael had explained to Elizabeth, was the need for private mourning, while part was to avoid distracting the nation from its new sovereign by allowing images of its former one wandering the palace to get out. Though that might no longer be the problem he thought it was, Michael had aged a great deal since the accident, to the point where a casual observer might fail to recognize him at all, certainly not at first glance. But while his face was more lined and his hair had gone thin, his eyes were as bright and alert as ever.
"I take it there was more, Your Grace?" Elizabeth asked as she walked into the room.
"Your Majesty," he said,
scrambling to his feet and bowing to her.
"I'm sorry. I expected you to be longer. No matter. I just wanted to offer my apologies for the... well, for all of it, I suppose. I'm so sorry."
"As well you should be," Elizabeth said, more harshly than she'd intended. "Did you know about this in advance?"
"Easy, Elizabeth," Michael said quietly. "None of this is his fault."
Elizabeth grimaced. He was right.
"I know," she said. "My apologies, Your Grace."
"No apology needed, Your Majesty,"
Burgundy assured her.
"And to answer your question, no, I didn't know."
His lip twitched.
"At least, not far enough in advance. I did know about his first point, which was why I wished to accompany him in the first place. We were already on our way into the palace when he told me what his second point was going to be, which,"
he added, his expression darkening even more,
"made me even gladder that I'd come along."
"I see."
The emotional tsunami had faded far enough now for Elizabeth's rational mind to start operating again. And the first rational question needed to be,
"Does he have a case?"
"I don't know, Your Majesty," Burgundy admitted. "The Constitution states unambiguously that the heir to the throne must marry a commoner. Unfortunately, whether that means you have to marry, or whether it simply means that if the heir marries, he or she must marry a commoner, is somewhat less clear. And the language does specifically refer to the heir to the throne."
"Well, I'm not the heir," Elizabeth said more than a bit bitterly.
"I know, Your Majesty,"
Burgundy replied gently.
"The problem is that the peers Breakwater was referring to are construing the language rather more broadly than I believe it was ever meant to be construed. They're taking the position that the provision is intended to assure that any future monarch has at least one parent from outside the aristocracy. The reason the Constitution requires that the heir must marry a commoner is to bring about that specific end. And, unfortunately, the marriage requirement is combined in the same clause of the Constitution as the requirement that any new monarch must be the heir of the body of the previous monarch, unless the monarch dies without issue."
"You're saying that's one interpretation of the Constitution?"
"Yes, Your Majesty."
Burgundy inclined his head slightly.
"A countervailing interpretation is that although the heir is required to marry a commoner in order to ensure that, as the Constitution itself says, crown and commons are perpetually wed, extraordinary circumstances, such as your own, aren't actually covered. That's my own opinion of what the drafters intended, as a matter of fact. The problem is that the Constitution's still in what you might call its infancy,"
Michael added.
"Or at least its adolescence."
"Exactly,"
Burgundy said, nodding.
"Your brother, King Edward, was actually the first heir to the throne to marry anyone since its ratification. Your grandmother and your father were both already married before the Constitution was drafted. The truth is that, as yet, no reigning monarch has ever married. So that means we are in what the lawyers like to call a gray area. And there are likely to be plenty of people wanting to push constitutional interpretation their way, for a whole range of reasons. We are already seeing plenty of debate over strict constructionism and living document reinterpretation to suit points people think weren't adequately covered or in which circumstances may have changed."
Elizabeth looked at her father.
My reading is the same, Michael said, nodding. We can call in a legal scholar to get something more definitive, but I'm betting we'll get conflicting views. Of course, neither Davis nor I are constitutional lawyers, but we were both there when it was written. I'm afraid I wasn't paying as much attention to it as he was, and I should have been, since it was going to have such an impact on our family. My own memory is that Davis is right, but he's also right that God knows a profitable business has grown up already around interpreting constitutional law. Frankly, I'm strongly in favor of supporting the strict constructionist school.
As were your grandmother and your great-grandfather, Burgundy said. They were damned insistent that if the Constitutional Convention was going to fundamentally rewrite the way we governed ourselves, then the rules it set forth had to be the rules, not something we decided to change any time they got a little inconvenient.
Exactly, Michael agreed. I remember Mom, your grandmother, saying that the very best thing we could do as a family and as future monarchs was to put as much grit into the system as we could, because, more than anything else, it was going to be our job to maintain stability. Having said that, though, we probably do need to start looking into current expert opinion on it.
That won't be necessary, Elizabeth said, because I'm not going to marry again. Not yet. Absolutely not simply because someone else tells me to.
Understood, Eli.
Burgundy glanced at the guards at the door.
Your Majesty,
he corrected himself. Elizabeth felt her throat tighten. Even a man old enough to be her grandfather, a man who'd watched her grow up and who'd held her hand through this whole horrific crisis, now couldn't bend enough to be her friend instead of her subject. Edward had sometimes talked about how lonely the monarch could be. Elizabeth had usually dismissed such comments as overdramatic grumbling. Little had she known.
More concerning to me, Michael said, is the question he didn't bring up. Namely, what happens with the line of succession?
Elizabeth stared at him. She'd been so preoccupied with Breakwater's marriage thing that the succession hadn't even occurred to her.
Your father's right, Burgundy agreed soberly. Your three stepchildren aren't eligible. They're not your biological offspring. And the Constitution definitely does specify that the crown can pass only to the heirs of your great-grandfather, King Roger. With Richard, Sophie, and Edward gone, he shook his head, we may be on the edge of more than just a constitutional crisis here, Your Majesty. We could conceivably lose the whole Winton line.
He lifted his hands, palms upward.
And then what?
Unless I remarry, Elizabeth murmured.
Unless you remarry.
Or find another solution, Michael said.
Abruptly, Elizabeth noticed that she and Burgundy were both still standing.
We need to discuss this further, she said, gesturing the Prime Minister back to his chair. Do you have time now?
I always have time for my Queen, Your Majesty, he said.
I think my schedule's clear too, Michael added dryly.
Unbidden, a smile touched Elizabeth's lips. Even unnaturally aged with grief, her father had the ability to lighten her mood.
Thank you, she said. Thank you both.
She walked over to her father's couch and sat down beside him.
Let's start by pulling up a copy of the Constitution. After that, we'll want a sampling of relevant commentary for the past 60 years.
And perhaps speak privately with the handful of writers like Davis who are still around, Michael said.
Yes, excellent point, Elizabeth agreed. We need to know what the document says, what the writers meant it to say.
She smiled briefly at the two men, but the smile faded quickly.
And what the experts think it says.
Chapter 15. General House hadn't been happy that neither Lynn nor any of the others of his team would be going to Barca with them. But he'd accepted the second payment with mostly good grace and headed back to the Grand Duke with the goodies. Now it was time to head over to Telmach and see how many of Jensen's people were still breathing. Of course, given the number of battlecruisers the damned Manticorans still had, the entire Volsung force could still be alive. If Jensen had realized his pre-battle intelligence was off and had run for it without firing a single shot, none of them would have gotten so much as a scratch. But if there had been a fight, especially given the Manticoran's obviously minimal losses, he could have gotten hammered pretty damned badly. And if that had happened, it was unlikely he'd blame anything but his faulty intelligence for it. Given that, and given Jensen's reputation and temper, a slower, more careful approach was called for.
"Sir, we've received a transmission from Poznan Customs," Katura reported. "A stock-sounding welcome to their system and a list of the services they offer."
"Along with the associated prices, I see," Lin said dryly, running an eye down the list. In his limited experience with the Silesian Confederacy, the main sport was attempting to gouge everyone in sight on every good and service imaginable. Not that there was much of either in a backwoods place like this. Still, what was available was definitely being overcharged for. Unfortunately, they had a monopoly. If you didn't want to pay their prices, you had to go elsewhere, assuming you had the range to do that. "Nice to see Silesia maintaining its new frontier charm," he continued. "Go ahead and transmit our greetings and compliments, Captain, and put in an order for a complete refueling when we reach the station."
"Sir, we don't have to do this," Katura protested. "We have more than enough fuel."
"I know," Lin said. "But if the Manticorans pounded hard enough on Jensen, he might have stopped on his way back to Telmach, or to wherever his real shipyard is. Poznan, Silesia, and Saginaw are his three most likely choices, and we just happen to have an asset on the Obronchka refueling station."
"Really?"
Katura asked, clearly surprised.
"I didn't know we had anyone here."
"He's mostly an independent stringer, but he's always been reliable. He gets a cut on purchases we make at his station, and whenever he refuels one of our ships, we let him add 5% to the invoice without squawking.
I assume no one in accounting ever sees that 5%?
"Exactly," Lin said. "We don't have the same arrangement in Silesia and Saginaw, which is why I sent Vagen and Ramus to poke around there. Banshee and Shrike are better equipped for poking around on their own than we are."
"I see, sir,"
Katura said. He seemed a bit surprised by the depth of the explanation. Axelrod operatives weren't in the habit of sharing need-to-know information. But he'd been so clearly unhappy with the decision to detach Banshee and Shrike that Lin had decided he deserved a bit more background. Still, Lin couldn't argue the point that splitting an already small force was never a good idea.
"I still don't know why Jensen would bother to stop off here," Katura said.
His tone was less unhappy than it had been, but he clearly remained far from completely mollified by Lin's explanation.
"If he made it this far, he could certainly make it the rest of the way to Telmach."
"Unless he expected the Manticorans to be on his tail," Lin pointed out. "In that case, he might stop by one of these other systems to make a few large purchases and try to throw off any pursuit."
"You think he's that clever?"
"Not really," Lin conceded. "But he could have gotten himself killed in the battle and left someone smarter in charge. Regardless, it's worth checking out." There was a barely heard sigh.
"Yes, sir."
Lin smiled. Katura was a good pilot and a highly competent associate. It had been totally the luck of the draw that he'd been available when Lin needed a crew after stealing that courier ship on Casca. But then, luck had always been one of Lin's best assets. Some Black Ops agents, Lin knew, believed themselves to be infallible and had no patience for anyone else's ideas or suggestions. But Lin had seen that kind of hubris backfire too many times. Encouraging Katura's questions and input meant another set of eyes and an additional brain on tap, and that was almost always a good thing. At least until the operation commenced. At that point, Lin required instant, unquestioning obedience. He hadn't had a chance yet to test Katura and his crew under fire, but that moment would come.
"Sir?"
Katura's voice came again, breaking into his thoughts.
"Take a look at the tactical."
Lin swiveled around to that display. It took him a moment to spot the flashing icon the captain had highlighted, just over 3 light minutes distant from Pacemaker.
"I see it," he said. "What about it?"
"It just changed vector, sir," Katura said. "It was headed for Pietz. Now it's not."
Lin frowned as he considered the data codes beside the icon. The transponder beacon identified it as an Andermani freighter, the Haman, and its current acceleration was a comfortably conservative 80 gravities. 3 light minutes was closer proximity than one might normally expect here in Poznan, but that was only because traffic was so sparse. It wasn't so much a matter of their finding themselves in close physical proximity as it was the oddity of 2 ships arriving at such a backwater system so close to simultaneously. The Poznan system was unusual among inhabited star systems in several ways. The most striking was that it contained not 1 but 2 gas giants inside its 18.92 light-minute hyperlimit. The outer of the 2 was Obronshka, pacemaker's destination. Pietz, the inner giant, was just outside the relatively cool G7 primary's habitable zone, but the planet itself was hot enough, the name meant furnace, to bring the surface temperatures of its moons up to near terrestrial levels. 2 of them, Kuznya and Palanisko, Forge and Hearth, were both massive enough to generate atmospheres, hydrospheres, and respectable gravities, and warm enough to support life. Both were tidelocked to Pietz, though, and their short day-night cycles took some getting used to. They were the only habitable real estate in the system, so it wasn't surprising that the ship Keturah had highlighted had been headed there. Obviously, the other vessel's hyperastrogation hadn't been perfect. It seldom was, really, especially over lengthy distances. Astrogators tried to hit as close as possible to a least time course to destinations inside a star's hyperlimit, but it wasn't uncommon to emerge from hyper as much as 2 or even 3 light minutes from one's intended alpha translation. Keturah was one of the better astrogators Lin had worked with, and even so, Pacemaker had emerged from hyper a good 20 light seconds from his intended locus. At the moment, Pietz and Obronshka were approaching conjunction, both on the same side of the primary with Pietz's smaller orbital radius catching up on Obronshka's from behind. It would be some months yet before they aligned perfectly, but it wasn't too surprising that ships heading for either of them should emerge from hyper in fairly close proximity. Except that if Keturah was right, the Andermani had just changed course.
"She not only changed heading, sir, but she also just brought up her wedge to do it," Keturah continued. "I ran back the record, and it turns out she shut down her impellers for about 39 minutes before she brought her wedge back up and changed course."
Lin looked at the time cut on Haman's vector change. The freighter's impeller signature had indeed disappeared from Pacemaker's tracking systems at the time Keturah had specified. Perhaps more ominously, that had been just over 2.5 minutes after Haman could have detected and read Pacemaker's transponder.
"Maybe it's a technical problem," he suggested.
"Obronshka is closer than Pietz if she's got problems."
"I don't think so, sir," Keturah said. "To reach her current point, assuming she's held constant acceleration since crossing the limit, she would have been in system for over an hour before we arrived, and she was only about 6.5 hours from Pietz. She can cut about 3 hours off that by making for Obronshka. But if she had some sort of engineering problem, and it was severe enough to make it necessary for her to change course to save that short an amount of time, she ought to be broadcasting a distress signal. Only she isn't."
Lin gazed at the display, an unpleasant feeling creeping up his back. The timing here was suspicious, to say the least. Of course, there were always 2 or 3 possible explanations for anything. Still, he'd learned over the years to trust his instincts, and Keturah seemed to have excellent instincts of his own, if the captain didn't like this.
"Sir, she's changing vector again," Keturah said.
"I see it," Lin said, feeling his eyes narrow.
The freighter had executed a slight yaw turn, adding another small sideways component to its original Pietz-bound vector.
"Get me a new projection."
"Working on it, sir, but that yaw was so slight.
Here we go." "Hell."
"Indeed," Lin agreed, the unpleasant creeping feeling on his back breaking into a full gallop. 2 vectors extended themselves across the display. 1 was Pacemaker's, headed for orbital insertion around Obronshka. The other was Haman's, which was now headed toward Obronshka, but not directly to Obronshka. Instead, its new course would intersect Pacemaker's just over 7 million kilometers short of the planet. And if both ships maintained current profiles, their velocities toward the planet would match almost exactly when Haman crossed Pacemaker's track at a range of less than 500,000 kilometers. Haman would be on a heading slightly away from Obronshka at a fairly shallow angle, but her crossing velocity when she intersected Pacemaker's course would be less than 200 kilometers per second. The freighter was hunting Pacemaker. She was being subtle about it, with a small enough deviation from a direct course to Obronchka that System Patrol probably wouldn't notice and wonder what she was up to. Or, for that matter, small enough to be plausibly explained if System Patrol did ask what she was doing. But she was hunting Pacemaker. Lin shifted his eyes to the status board. Pacemaker was still running the Barkan beacon they'd used back at Manticore, mainly because they had it and there was no reason to put together a new throwaway ID. So who the hell out here would want to bother a nondescript Barkan courier ship? And then abruptly he got it.
You think it's a pirate? Keturah suggested.
It's not a pirate, Captain, Lin said grimly. I wish to hell it was. It's Jensen.
Jensen? Keturah repeated disbelievingly. What's he doing on a freighter?
I seriously doubt that's just a freighter, Lin ground out, thinking hard.
But why would he be running an Andermani ID?
You know anyone around here who'd mess with an Andermani? Lin countered. Makes for great camouflage, especially since the conventional wisdom is that Andermani freighters are routinely armed. Keturah grunted.
Terrific.
I wouldn't worry too much about it, Lin said, more confidently than he actually felt. By the time they cross our course, they'll be too close to Obronchka for them to try anything blatant.
Unless System Patrol doesn't want to mess with them either.
System Patrol knows its job better than that, Lin said, frowning at the tactical display while he tried to get inside Jensen's head. As he pointed out to Keturah, they'd be within little more than half a light minute of Obronchka, basically shouting range by the time their courses intersected. Unfortunately, shouting range wasn't remotely the same as shooting range. Given their new vectors, the freighter would pass within 7 million kilometers of the planet before her current heading took her back out across the hyperlimit at a fairly shallow angle. So even if there were System Patrol units in Obronchka's orbit, they'd be millions of kilometers outside missile range of the intercept point. Even if they were inclined to intervene, they wouldn't be able to unless they got underway in the next 45 minutes or so. Worse, to get to that range in time to do anything about it, they'd have to pile up so much Delta V that they'd go right past Pacemaker and Haman on opposing vectors with a closing rate of over 11,000 kPS, which would take them through their entire engagement envelope in barely 45 seconds. Unless they had enough cause to simply blow the freighter out of space as they passed, there was no way they could stay in engagement range long enough to do any good, or, for that matter, even overtake Haman before her vector took her back across the hyperlimit and safely out of both their range and their jurisdiction. Pacemaker, on the other hand, was headed directly into the system, and she'd built too much velocity to simply stop and go back the way she'd come. She was still 40 minutes short of her own turnover point for a 0-0 orbital insertion at her destination. But if Haman was serious about intercepting her, and willing to be more obvious about it, she could change course enough to catch Pacemaker closer to the courier boat's turnover point before she was able to generate much velocity back towards the limit. The crossing rate would be higher, but Haman could do it. And if she had any appreciable acceleration left in reserve, she could do it even sooner, or at a lower crossing rate, which would leave her within theoretical missile range longer.
All right, Lin said slowly. If we maintain profile and he holds his current acceleration, he'll get within 450,000 kilometers of us at closest approach. Correct?
Yes, sir.
So what happens if we don't make turnover? If we just keep accelerating straight in system past him?
Depends on whether or not he really is a freighter, Keturah said. If 80 gravities is his maximum safe acceleration, then his maximum acceleration with a zero margin on his compensator is only 100. But from his wedge strength and his current acceleration, it looks like he's probably somewhere around 1 million to 1.5 million tons. If he is, and if he's got a military-grade compensator, he could conceivably hit twice that. He could come within 20 or 30 gravities of us anyway.
And that means?
That means he could add velocity a lot faster than a freighter could. And at the moment, he's got the base velocity advantage. He'll still have it when we hit our turnover point, too. If he can hit within, call it 28 gravities of our acceleration,
He can still catch us by simply delaying his own turnover point.
And we make turnover before he does, Lin said, wincing.
Exactly. He'd have time to adjust if we didn't.
Lin stroked his lip thoughtfully. On the other hand, if they continued to accelerate and Haman adjusted to intercept them short of Obronchka, Jensen would be forced to break profile as an innocent freighter. At the moment, he could be headed for Obronchka. His astrogation would be a little off, but he'd have plenty of time to correct it, and no one would be worrying about it yet. For that matter, even when he crossed Pacemaker's projected track, his velocity away from Obronchka would be so low that it would add only about 95 minutes to an orbital rendezvous with the planet. But if he altered that profile in obvious response to Pacemaker's maneuvers, he'd risk inspiring suspicion in any system patrol unit in Obronchka's vicinity. Soon enough, it might actually be able to intervene after all. Still, Jensen or not, it still had to be a commercial hull. It was headed for Pietz, which meant it was headed towards system patrol. Surely they wouldn't take kindly to a warship falsely identifying itself as a freighter, and a warship couldn't pretend to be anything else once it got into visual observation range. So whatever it was, at least it wasn't a cruiser or a destroyer. Unfortunately, one of Lin's intelligence sources had warned that Jensen might have a couple of armed freighters. Out here, where naval patrols were few and far between, armed merchantmen were hardly uncommon, and Poznan System Patrol probably wouldn't turn much of a hair over one as long as it behaved itself. Especially if it claimed to be Andermani. Gustav Andermann was a tough-minded old buzzard, and he'd made it a point to ensure that everyone, especially including pirate gangs, knew his freighters were as well-armed as many a warship. He was also the sort of man the Poznan authorities wouldn't care to annoy without very good reason. More to the point, if Haman had any weaponry at all, then it was automatically superior to Pacemaker, which didn't mount even a single pop gun. The bottom line was if Jensen managed to get into missile range with minimal difference between their vectors and demanded Pacemaker heave to for a rendezvous, Pacemaker would have no choice but to obey. And since they'd still be 7 million kilometers from Obronchka, Jensen could then drop his mask, seize or destroy Lin, and be gone before anyone in Poznan could do a damn thing about it. Unless there was enough difference between their vectors that Pacemaker could somehow squeak into Obronchka orbit, or at least break past Haman before Jensen overhauled her. Try this, he said. Assume he wants to intercept us 7 million clicks short of Obronchka. We make turnover, all fat, dumb, and happy, and both of us maintain our current profiles and